Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sanya Bebic, Director of the Cultural Orientation Resource Center at the Center for Applied Linguistics. Welcome to today's webinar on the Refugee Health Orientation Continuum. This webinar is being offered as a partnership between the Center for Applied Linguistics, Cultural Orientation Resource Center. We are a technical assistance provider for refugee orientation and new groups co-funded by PRM and ORR, and also RICTAC, Refugee Health Technical Assistance Center, the ORR-funded national technical assistance provider for health and mental health. Today's webinar is an opportunity to have a dialogue about the refugee health orientation continuum from the overseas portion through the domestic portion of the health orientation continuum. And to represent that, we have four overseas CO coordinators representing four overseas resettlement support centers presenting on today's webinar, as well as two domestic presenters representing the domestic health orientation and service provision area. Before we get started with our presentations, I just wanted to provide a little bit of context on overseas cultural orientation. What you're seeing on your screen is the locations around the world of the seven resettlement support centers that process refugees for U.S. resettlement, and these seven resettlement support centers also house cultural orientation programs, as cultural orientation takes place as one of the elements and one of the steps in the process that U.S.-bound refugees go through. Overseas cultural orientation is funded in all of these locations by Department of State, Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration, but it is delivered by a number of different agencies, some US-based, some international organizations, in a variety of locations as the map shows. In terms of topics that are addressed in orientation, on average, there are about 20 hours of classroom time that are used to address the 11 topics that you see on your screen. As you can see, health is one of those topics, and it is typically addressed in about an hour in most programs. However, the key messages that are emphasized by different programs, depending on populations, vary from program to program. The point in time in which health and mental health are addressed in the CO cycle also varies from program to program, and we will see four different examples of that represented by the four overseas CO coordinators that will be presenting on today's webinars. They will each focus on specific points and areas of the health and mental health topic that they address with their populations in the respective locations where they work.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Peter Selnikowski. I'm the Cultural Orientation Coordinator for IOM in Nepal. Thank you very much for joining us. I know there's a lot of interest in mental health as a result of the suicides amongst the Bhutanese, and I'd like to show you what we in Nepal do in terms of lessons on mental health. Here, we start the class with a silly game. Actually, it's not so silly. There's a purpose to this. We want to get them to laugh and relax and forget their problems at home and focus on what we're going to be doing in class. Some of the activities are meant to create trust between the trainers and the students and the students themselves, because we're going to be talking about some serious matters. We have many activities that relate to mental health. This one is called Three Glasses of Water. What are you going to be like when you get to America? Will you be like the oil and water and separate yourself from American society? Will you be like the sugar and water, forget your own culture and become American? Or will you be like the orange juice and water with a little bit of give and a little bit of take? We made a video to explore attitudes necessary for success. Will you be passive, like the people in the picture here, just complaining about their problems and not doing anything about it? Will you be aggressive, yelling at your caseworker? Or will you be proactive and polite? family roles in Nepal. What are your family? What are the roles of each member of your family? What are the roles of Americans in America? What will your role be as a Nepalese in America? Will your roles change? How? What will it mean for your family? Here we separate the children from their parents, or the youth from their parents, and we look at a number of things and we say, is this something that parents should be strict on or flexible on? Here the young man says, this is all right. But father says, no way, I'll kill them before I let them do this. A senior in America. One of our trainers went on a Cal exchange a few years ago and met one woman who hadn't left her home in 3 months. This old man sits at home all day with nobody but the TV for company. This is a very vulnerable group, obviously. So we created lessons for them. Remember the family rules lesson a few slides back? Here's how one group of seniors saw their role in the U.S. You notice on top, the Bhutanese granny in Nepal has a lot to do. American grandparents also have a lot to do. But Bhutanese elderly in America, they didn't plan on doing anything, just sitting at home, being taken care of by their children. We get the families together and we discuss the topic. Obviously, something is not right here. What are you going to do about it? We discuss the culture shock graph, the honeymoon, the disillusionment, the slow recovery. And then we look at the individual. Are you susceptible to culture shock? We lay out green, yellow, and red buttons on the floor, and then we read a number of statements. For example, can you speak English? If you can speak English, you take a green button. If you cannot speak English, you take a red button. Red signifies danger. So you see from this picture, which of the three generations are the most in danger of culture shock. Now, finally, as a result of the Bhutanese suicides in the U.S., we made a culture shock video. Here it is. A Bhutanese family arrives in the U.S. At first, everything is wonderful. Dilmaya writes home to a friend, what a great place this is. And now we stop the film and we hold a discussion. What's happening in the family? Is every member of the family feeling the same? What should happen next? What will happen next? The caseworker comes and says, Dilmaya, you need to get a job. But Dilmaya is not happy about it. She wants to go to school. Granny has been depressed. In fact, throughout the whole video, she's depressed. She never wanted to come to the U.S. in the first place. And Kishore is in trouble with school. He has got in with a gang, and now he's skipping school. He says, they're the only friends I have. Father gives up learning English. He hates this place. And he started drinking now. And mother's at the end of her rope. She doesn't know what to do with every member of the family having great difficulties. Dilmaya gets a job, finally. But is she happy? No. She writes home again. At this point, there's not a dry eye in the house. The video is quite depressing, as you can see, but we don't end it there. The activity ends in a role play. We ask them, what must this family do to come up to a happy ending? And generally, these are the conclusions that they come up with. These latter two are actually something new for the Bhutanese, because as a family, they tell us, they never talk to each other. The father makes the decisions, and everybody else does what father says. An immediate effect of this lesson is that families have come back to class the next day and said, we didn't sleep last night for talking about this all night long. Before they travel to the U.S., they spend 4 days at the transit center in Kathmandu, and we give them some supplementary classes here. Class on stereotypes. They're afraid of African Americans. Our lesson shows that it's not fair to stereotype everyone as to be the same. We have lessons on sexual harassment for the protection of both the men and the women. We have a lesson called Yahoos and Zizus, which gives participants a chance to explore what it's like to meet people of a different culture that have different cultural norms. We have men's and women's sessions where we separate the men from the women. These become pretty much a free-for-all, as they can talk about whatever they want. We have lessons on safety. This is their number one concern. And so we teach, even in the daycare center, we teach the kids how to cross the street, how not to get mugged like this guy, or how not to get raped if you're a girl. And finally, a lesson on family violence. Our challenges. We've got about 20 hours of lessons here and only a maximum of 4 or 5 hours in which to deliver this. Relatives in the U.S. may say there's no problem. So who are they going to believe, their relatives or us? And finally, you can't change a lifetime's attitudes in a few hours. So thank you very much for your attention.
Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Krause. I serve as Cultural Orientation Regional Coordinator with CWS RSC Nairobi. In this presentation, I'll provide you with a very brief overview of the training conducted in sub-Saharan Africa and then focus on the training provided on health, looking specifically at how we try to modify the training based on the populations being trained. Cultural orientation in sub-Saharan Africa is conducted by CWS RSC Nairobi. Our trainers, pictured here to the right, good-looking group, I think, are experienced in intercultural communication and education and have a collective proficiency in English, Somali, and Kiswahili. We're responsible for the processing of refugees in 45 different countries. Our staff is based in Nairobi, and they travel to urban and camp locations throughout the region to conduct our trainings. Staff may be in the field anywhere from a few days to several weeks at a time. The objectives of cultural orientation in sub-Saharan Africa are really threefold. One, to inform participants of the processes and systems that will impact on their resettlement experience. Two, to assist participants in developing realistic expectations regarding the U.S. and their resettlement experience. And as you can imagine, that can sometimes be challenging. And three, to equip participants with the skills and attitudes necessary to enable them to have a really positive acculturation experience. In the past, cultural orientation may have been thought of as the few days of training refugees receive before they travel to the U.S., but I think this is changing. We're working now to provide more information to refugees throughout the process to help them make a more informed decision about their participation in the U.S. Refugee admissions program. And this happens in the camps, at RSC interviews, and of course in the CO training sessions. Cultural orientation in sub-Saharan Africa takes a variety of forms, and this is due in large part to the diversity of our caseload. Standard cultural orientation is generally 3 working days, 6 hours per day, and targets those ages 15 years and above. The training is based largely on the CAL, Welcome to the U.S. Guidebook, and places emphasis on the objectives and indicators laid out by CAL and PRM as part of the recent Objectives and Indicators Project. Because of their limited exposure to Western ways of life, standard CO for Central African Republic refugees in Chad is 5 working days, and CO for children and youth is also provided. For Somali youth, a special day of training is provided. This, in addition to the 3 days of standard CO, As you can see here, it's for those ages 15 to 26. And for URMs, a minimum of 3 hours of CO training specific to the URM program is provided. The training is conducted using the Cal On Their Way URM curriculum. This is an overview of the things covered in the standard training, and we'll talk specifically about what's discussed in health in the following slides. As I mentioned, our standard curriculum places emphasis on the objectives and indicators laid out by Cal and PRM. This is a summary of the objectives related to health. Depending on the refugee group being trained and their familiarity with these concepts, more or less time may be spent on each objective. In all of the trainings we conduct, including the one on health, we use a variety of training methods to make sure the refugees understand and retain the information that's shared with them. As much as possible, we try to identify training methods most appropriate to the populations being trained. This can be challenging, as sometimes we have different populations in class at one time. For example, we may have someone who served as a doctor in his or her home country sitting next to someone else who's never held a pencil. Further challenging is that these two refugees may not even speak the same language. To the right is an example of a visual aid that's used in our health training. This is part of a larger poster that was developed for the refugees on what to pack for their travel to the U.S. As you can see, the refugees are encouraged to pack medicine with a prescription for the first 30 days. And it's important to note the need for the prescription, as many prescription medications in sub-Saharan Africa are available over the counter from local chemists. Note that refugees are also encouraged through the poster to pack a toothbrush and toothpaste, sanitary pads, diapers for infants, and deodorant. While camp-based refugees are typically provided these items through IOM, who arranges for their travel, other refugees may not be. We've also used this poster as an activity, working with the refugees to actually pack a carry-on and checked bag. Other visual aids in sub-Saharan Africa that you may be familiar with include the Cover Your Cough poster developed in the state of Minnesota and the USCRI book on services available to disabled refugees. This book has been useful in locations where there are more disabled refugees, such as those refugees coming from Ethiopia's Kepervaya refugee camp. Another training method used has been working models. To the left is a picture of a Somali refugee from Kenya's Dadaab refugee camp, demonstrating hand washing. The use of working models has been especially important in working with camp-based populations, such as Eritrean refugees in Ethiopia's Shamalba refugee camp. Of course, also used are activities. One health activity that's been especially effective in sub-Saharan Africa is what's in the bag? Similar to the hygiene kit used by IRC RSC Bangkok, a bag is filled with hygiene items such as deodorant, soap, and sanitary pad. One volunteer is asked to come to the front of the room and reach into the bag without looking and pull out the item. And depending on the populations with whom we're working, we may have a separate bag for the males and for the females. The volunteer is then asked to explain what the item is and how to use it. They're then asked, according to American standards, how often should you use this item? For those refugees who may be at a level slightly higher than the others, we may ask for their assistance in leading the activity. At the conclusion of the activity, the participants are asked reflection questions such as, what are the consequences of not adopting American basic hygiene standards, and what are the advantages? The participants are all then given the opportunity to come up to the front of the classroom and examine the items. And this is a photo of some of our Somali women checking out the deodorant from the bag. We're very interested in getting feedback both from you and from the refugees we serve. If you have any comments or questions for us, you can write to us at the email address listed here, or email the folks at Cal, and they'll forward that communication on to us or post it in an upcoming Refugee Listserv discussion. We really look forward to continuing to partner with you in strengthening the orientation provided to refugees resettling to the U.S.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Jamal Afakori. I'm the Regional Cultural Orientation Coordinator for RSC Amman, which covers refugees destined to the U.S. from Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Egypt, and a bunch of other countries in the region. I cannot count them all for time consideration. As you have learned from my colleagues before, we all cover same topics. CO in the Middle East is 4 days, 20 hours. It's mandatory, so not all refugees choose to attend, but we have about 82%. We'll talk more general information about CO on Thursday, I believe, is the next webinar. Today, I want to talk to you specifically about managing expectations and forming helpful attitude towards resettlement. We deal with, 99% of our caseload is Iraqi refugees. So our coverage of the health unit is not just that one unit. We cover attitude throughout the 4 days. I'm going to go through a bunch of activities that we cover through our classrooms, and hopefully that will give you an idea about what type of messages or key messages we send to refugees who attend our classrooms. This one also covered by Peter Sadinkowski and IOM Damak. It's the same exercise. It's designed to give refugees heads up that they will have some sort of integration or acculturation problem upon arrival. It will vary from refugee to refugee, and it will vary from city to city or site of resettlement to site of resettlement, but they're all, it's going to present challenges to every resettled refugee. The next one is what we call East versus West cultural icons, and basically we show this, there is 12 slides, and we show it to refugees, and they draw their own conclusions. So one of our favorite ones that get refugees always going is this one. As you can see in the right, the red box, we have a bunch of people standing in front of a service provider, and what it should be to the left in the blue where everybody queues up to receive the service. This one always a good one. Okay. This is always a good one. It talks about how we go from point A to point B in the West and how we go about it in the East. This is just designed to give refugees an idea of the differences in cultures that they will face. The next one is what we call social core values. Refugees are presented with a set of situations where it compares East or their culture from Iraq against American culture. And it's also designed to help refugees develop healthy attitudes towards resettlement and accept that the change once resettled to the U.S. is going to be huge. Another one is this one, and as you can tell, we're heavy on visuals. So this one, for example, is put there so that we can say to refugees, they're not going to be bidets in bathrooms in the U.S. Your caseworker is not somebody who's going to carry your luggage for you. And then, this is a realistic expectation where your caseworker will receive you at the airport and your resettlement agency will assist you in finding a job, but it's not mandatory, meaning that you as a refugee have to seek assistance to find a job. They will not find you a job while you're sitting home. This activity is designed to manage expectations about housing. We present to refugees about 6 pictures each, and they will have to decide which of these pictures look like a place where they're going to reside in the first 30 days, in the first year, or 5 years after arrival. And the message is clear is that, you lower your expectations about housing because the VOLAGs, the resettlement agencies, are going to put you in a place where you have to pay the rent from your government cash assistance that you're going to receive after the 30 days. This activity covered also by Peter, it's about integration in the U.S., so I'm not going to spend too much time on it. This is family situations, what would you do? And it presents the refugees with various types of situations that they can, you know, expect to go through with their families once they are resettled. This is the stages of cultural adjustment, and we've all spoke about the honeymoon phase, and then you go down, cultural shock, and then most people will move up to adjustment, but there are those who go into depression and stage five. And this is where we touch upon mental health, and we tell refugees that, you know, somebody in stage five, they definitely need to seek counseling, and they can ask the resettlement agency about where they can go to receive help in that regard. Then this is our main activity on health. It's a snakes and ladders activity. I know other RSCCO programs use this one as well. And it basically it talks about a number of things. Dangers of fast food, importance of exercise, what type of medical coverage in the U.S., how do I go about getting prescriptions, when do I call 911? Talks about Medicare for seniors. And the big one is, what are the risks of living with no health insurance? You know, this is probably the main activity on health that we use, but we focus our many activities in our curriculum towards developing healthy attitudes. I want to finish by thanking you for your time and looking forward to answering some of your questions. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Jason Kretzler from RSC Bangkok. I'm going to talk about some lessons that we use in Thailand and in Malaysia to address preventative health and hygiene topics during cultural orientation. At the IRC RSC East Asia, in addition to disseminating information regarding healthcare options in the U.S., we also focus on a few other issues to promote preventative health in CO. Topics like nutrition, general preventative health, and hygiene are ones that our refugee population may not be too familiar with, due to camp conditions in Thailand or to the urban conditions in Kuala Lumpur. Rations are very limited nutritionally, and there might not be a wide array of hygiene products available at most locations. One way we address the promotion of preventative health and nutrition is through the Healthy Living Tic-Tac-Toe lesson. The objectives of this lesson are for participants to be able to, one, understand the concept and importance of preventative care, and two, to list things, behaviors, and other things that they can do to stay healthy in the U.S. We begin with a class discussion by asking participants to describe their current healthcare situation and explain that while healthcare in the U.S. may be generally better to what is available to them now, it can be expensive and sometimes difficult to access. We then introduce the idea that there are things and behaviors that participants can do to promote their own health before they develop any serious health problems. The trainers then explain how to play tic-tac-toe, which is a game that is generally familiar to our populations. And we divide the class into two larger groups of 10 to 15 students. The trainer sets up the tic-tac-toe grid by placing 9 images face down on the board. And taking turns, each team is invited to name some things or behaviors that can promote health. As topics are named, the photos are flipped over and they're assigned an X for one team or an O for the other. Obviously, the game continues until all the tiles are revealed or until a team achieves 3 in a row. The 9 healthy behaviors that we discuss are drinking plenty of water, nutrition, eating a variety of foods, medical checkups, getting enough sleep, having healthy relationships with family and friends, exercise, practicing good personal hygiene, maintaining a clean environment, and avoiding or limiting unhealthy habits like smoking or drinking. As these are revealed, each topic is discussed in some detail with the class. And the lesson reminds participants of personal responsibilities when it comes to healthy living. Another activity that we do to address personal hygiene is very similar to what Sarah described that they do at RSC Nairobi. And that is a hygiene kit lesson. And the objective of this lesson is for participants to be able to understand and describe good personal hygiene habits. The class is divided into small groups, and they brainstorm and they're asked to list 5 to 7 important items that they use for staying clean. Once this is complete, the participants are brought back into one large group, and each in turn is asked to remove an item from the hygiene kit. So it's basically in a bag or under a cover, so they cannot see what they're taking. Once the student has an object, they're asked to say what it is and explain how to use it and how often to use it. So very similar to what Sarah described, some of the items inside include soap, toilet paper, toothpaste, razor, deodorant, shampoo, nail clippers, and some other items. Once everything has been passed around and discussed, the items are compared to the original list that they developed at the beginning of the lesson so they can compare and contrast personal hygiene responsibilities in the U.S. Thanks again for your time, and we look forward to any questions that you may have for us.
Thank you, Jason. Hello, everyone. Just a couple of housekeeping items before we move on to the domestic side of the presentation. One, we are aware that there have been difficulties with audio, and we will, if the quality of the recording of the audio that we plan on posting on our website and the RICTAC website is not good, we will re-record the presentations for which we do not have good audio, and those will be available on the website, as well as the PowerPoints from all of today's presentations, and we'll be letting everyone know when those will be up on both the Cal and the RICTAC website. Another thing I wanted to note before we move on to the domestic side of the presentation is that the presenters also have questions, some questions for webinar participants, both the overseas presenters and the domestic presenters. And we will have those come up on the screen at the end of the last presentation. And we hope that you will write in the comment box and perhaps provide some information that can be useful for overseas CO programs and our domestic presenters as well. And now I will turn it over to Jennifer Cochran, who will be introducing our domestic presenters.
Hi, thanks very much, Sonia. I would like to thank our colleagues from the Overseas CO programs for presenting. And I agree, the sound was tough at times, but you certainly gave us a wealth of visual images, and we hope to catch up then on some of the information to process. And on behalf of the Refugee Health Technical Assistance Center, we're really pleased to have this opportunity to partner with the Cultural Orientation Resource Center and the CO coordinators to discuss the topic of health orientation. As we move further along this continuum of health orientation to the post-resettlement phase, I'm really pleased to welcome Leslie Douglas and Liz Edgell, two health educators. And I'm going to remind the staff at Cal that you are advancing our slides for us, because that's where the slides are. So we should be ahead, a slide forward from where we are. I'm going to let them catch up. And while, okay, so if I could have the next slide now. So, and Leslie is with the Lowry Refugee Health Clinic in Denver, Colorado, where they provide screening, referral, and education services for resettled refugees. And Liz is with Family Health Centers in Louisville, Kentucky, a federally qualified community health center, And there she provides direct health education to individuals and groups of newly arrived refugees. Liz and Leslie also are co-chairs of the Association of Refugee Health Coordinators Health Education Committee, and in this role we really welcome them and their participation in today's webinar. For next slide, please. In the brief amount of time that we have, we're really only going to be able to introduce a summary of some of the types of health orientation that may happen post-resettlement, rather than focusing on specific programs or innovative strategies or promising practices. And our objectives are to first present an overview of some of the methods that are used for health orientation, to discuss the challenges that are there in providing health orientation, and to promote ideas for further collaboration and educational opportunities. And we're really hoping that today's webinar sparks a good discussion, and if the interest is there, then we would be able to plan a future more in-depth webinar on domestic health orientations with support from the Refugee Health Technical Assistance Center. So before we get started, I think Cal's going to come back, and they should be coming back with a poll question for us that we can just take a quick look at here. You have quiet because I'm waiting for the slides to come back. Okay, so just a very 2 seconds poll question, true or false? Do all refugees participate in a health orientation after resettlement? True, false, and it's not false, so here, but it's false. So go ahead and select your answer, and we'll move right into the results. And as those results are coming up, I'm going to turn this to Leslie as soon as the results are up, and she will take it from here.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Sure.
All right, so I'll wait until our slide comes up. All right. So again, my name is Leslie Douglas, and I work in Denver, Colorado, and I provide health orientation to refugees who come to Colorado. And in order to create this presentation, we tried to pull a variety of domestic health orientation service providers to see how they were providing health orientation. And what we found is that the method, topics, and amount of time covered really dramatically varies from state to state, from clinic to clinic, and resettlement agency to resettlement agency. So in the upcoming slides, we're going to discuss the different methods and topics that people discussed, and also the amount of time and when that health orientation occurs. So just to give one example of the variety of health education that's occurring, when pulling a variety of states, it was stated that anywhere between 15 minutes to 3 hours of health orientation is offered to refugees. And so as you can imagine, that would really create a diverse amount of information and retention that's occurring within the population. Next slide. Are we able to go to the next slide? Are we able to move to the next slide? All right, here we go. So there's a variety of service providers that are providing the health orientation. It's often occurring at the resettlement agencies through case managers and or health coordinators. It's sometimes occurring at ESL classes or centers, refugee health clinics, or at the local state health department where refugee screenings are occurring, with a very common place health orientation is happening. It's also happening at community health care providers, so possible places where refugees are being referred for ongoing health care. It's happening within some partner agencies, and most often what was listed was resident programs or medical students who might be assisting in providing that orientation. And then very common was some sort of mixed model approach. And for example, here in Colorado, refugee resettlement agencies do an initial intake, and then many refugees participate in cultural orientation classes through an ESL center, and then we also provide some health orientation during the health screening. All right, next slide. All right, so some of the different types of orientation materials and methods that are being used. Often at resettlement agencies, there might be some sort of individual or family intake meeting. And the types of activities that are going on during these would be assessing any critical medical concerns, assessing any medications that are being taken, and ensuring that people will get those medications filled in time, asking if there's any interest in family planning, and also evaluating to see if there are any mental health needs. Many people reported using some sort of PowerPoint presentation, and we'll talk about the different topics that are being discussed in those PowerPoint presentations. There's also videos available, and some of them have been translated into the native language of the client, while others are still in English and might be interpreted during a session, or possibly it was made for more of a limited English population, and so therefore people are watching it in English. Next slide. Also, many people reported using some small group teaching learning sessions that were typically divided up by ethnic population and language, and other people reported large group teaching learning sessions with multiple interpreters. Next slide. All right, and then many people also reported using written handouts, and we know this is not the best method to educate our refugee population, but it's what is available to us. Many people reported using the USCRI translated documents, and in the photo below you can see one of our refugees reading one of those documents. Many documents have been created and translated in-house for needs that maybe are not available through the USCRI website. And also, some people are using a health binder. We use one of these in Colorado. And it just provides an organizational tool for refugees for their health information, as well as has some translated information regarding resources available to them in the Denver area. Some people are also taking field trips. So one example of this was to a pharmacy where they might discuss the differences between over-the-counter medication and a prescription medication. And then a few states reported using health navigators, which has been told to us as a very successful model, but obviously more time-consuming and expensive, and so it's not occurring in as many places as we probably would like. Next slide. So in general, the health orientation themes that we're seeing, most refugees are offered some sort of general health orientation and also the overview of the U.S. healthcare system. But as you know, it's very complex, and so again, it's very general. Also, it was mostly discussed that it was population or language group based, so possibly using one interpreter to a similar ethnic population. And then there was a lot of information that's health topic based. And so in the upcoming slides, we'll talk about the different topics that are addressed in health orientation. So we'll often be teaching about what to expect at the initial refugee health screening, where the screening is located, when it will be, and why one should go. We'll discuss health insurance, such as RMA, Medicaid, and private insurance, as well as medical bills and what to do if you receive them. We'll discuss the healthcare system overview, using 911, how to use it and when to use it, roles and responsibilities of patients, providers, and case managers, how to make appointments and how to find a PCP. There's many preventative health topics that we discuss, including women's exams, well-child checks, nutrition. We discuss immunizations. Often this includes what types of immunizations people are receiving, the importance of them, and how that might relate to their green card application. Next slide. We discuss family planning, the options that are available, and where to reach these services, mental health, dental services, vision, different issues regarding nutrition, sometimes specific health issues a client is experiencing, and that might be done more of on a one-on-one basis, domestic violence, hand washing, bed bugs and scabies, how to care for a sick family member, how to manage medication and over-the-counter medications. Next slide. And just another thing that really varies based from state to state is the timing when refugees are receiving this health orientation, and I think this really can greatly affect how much the refugee is able to intake. Sometimes it was discussed that the health orientation is occurring just a few days after they've arrived. Sometimes it's occurring a few months after they've arrived, and most often it was discussed that it's happening several times throughout the new arrival period, and this is often, again, by various providing agencies and through various mediums. And so, again, it's more the mixed model approach. So next I'm going to turn it over to Liz, and she's going to discuss both the challenges that we're having to having quality health orientations and also some future ideas that we would like to propose.
Okay, hi everybody. Some of the challenges to quality orientations on the domestic end sound pretty similar to some of the challenges on the overseas side. A major concern is the lack of time for orientation, that a newly arrived refugee has a very busy schedule filled with appointments to get enrolled in different services, starting their English, their ESL classes, trying to find that all-important job, and then sometimes beginning work before they may have been able to go to all of these orientation services. Reaching everyone is a challenge. Sometimes the best way to catch everyone is to do the orientations very early on in their arrival, but that may not be when they're able to retain the most information. That's probably when they're the most overwhelmed. So that's a challenge. And then obviously the complexity of the U.S. healthcare system is an issue, and the fact that that U.S. healthcare system changes frequently. So this plenty of people struggle to navigate this system even if they were born and raised here, so we can only imagine that it's a harder challenge for these newly arrived refugees. And also in the upcoming years, we'll be seeing changes with the Affordable Care Act, so that's even more complexity being added on. Next slide. Also, services vary across states and across programs, so that this affects the way that material could be introduced overseas if they are going to start at that point, or it also limits our efforts to try to standardize orientations on the domestic side. There's also a lack of primary care resources at the local level often, so this means there's kind of a mismatch between the advice that we're giving to refugees about how you should find a primary care provider and you should access this care and you should clean your teeth every 6 months, and then the reality of being able to do those things. Limited insurance coverage is definitely a problem. Dental services are often uncovered, especially for adults. Vision services are often uncovered. Many refugees have limited health insurance in general and aren't eligible for state Medicaid programs. So that means it really affects the quality of care and the specialty care and referrals that they receive, because their insurance may run out before they get those actual appointments. And then issues like transportation. Orientations don't always address the most practical need or the area of highest concern for the refugee. It's challenging to give a really good overview of this very complicated system and then still address the immediate concerns that refugees have, like how am I going to get there, or how am I going to take off time from work. Very often when we see them, they already have jobs and they're in that probationary period, so they're afraid to take off time for their medical appointments. Next slide. Another challenge is that sometimes these programs end up being kind of basic information dissemination programs, kind of in one ear and out the other, and maybe too classroom oriented and less hands-on than they need to be. It's something that many of us are aware of, and yet the challenges of providing a good orientation kind of result in us having to continue to do it this way. There's concerns that maybe these orientations just have a minor impact, even though we're investing a lot of time, even though we're trying to use quality translated or tested resources. Refugees come from various places with different languages and cultures and different exposures to Western medicine, and sometimes your best bet is to get a whole group of people and just have interpreters all in the same room, and that makes it really difficult to tailor the presentation to their real needs. And that's also due in part to the next point, which is limited financial and staff resources. Even in the best of partnerships, sometimes caseworkers are doing more than they technically have to for clients. Clinic staff may be doing more than they would normally do for other patients. And yet there are still gaps, and clients or patients who fall between the cracks. And that's something we're all aware of, and we wish that we could correct. Next slide. So when we talk about future directions, some organizations have voiced to us that they're considering maybe covering less information, but to try to cover it in a more meaningful way, to reallocate that precious time and make it a more interactive session. We recognize that refugees may learn more by doing. We'd like to have some more research into when in the resettlement process refugees may learn the best. And then, of course, that we'd have to address that challenge still of how to reach them if it turns out that it's later in the resettlement process. And there's a move in general toward a community health worker system, a community health worker-based system, or having a health navigator-based program, and recognizing that refugees may learn best from their peers. But again, that's there are training needs there, there are financial needs there, so it's not a direction that everyone has moved towards yet. Next slide. This is a slide that actually does show preparing a community health worker and patient navigator workforce. This is from the Outreach Worker Training Institute in Massachusetts. So these are pictures of CHWs and patient navigators. This is a nice method and that a lot of developing countries already have community health workers, so it's a model that many folks are familiar with, and it would be nice if it were something that followed them here to the U.S. Next slide. So other considerations that also get involved in health orientation and is that information sharing piece, making sure that health information follows refugees. They're probably not accustomed to going to different service providers for different things or the idea of having specialists. And making sure that that important refugee health screening information follows the refugee, maybe giving them tools or teaching them about release of information forms and giving them some sort of tool that lets other community providers know that they've had a refugee health screening. Another consideration is the need to orient community health providers to best practices in refugee care. And then to empower refugees. Really, the goal is much more than just basic orientation or health education, but really to empower refugees. And that goes along with improving health literacy. So we know that health literacy is a problem for most Americans, and we can only imagine that it's a more of a challenge for folks who don't know how to navigate our complicated system or haven't had exposure to a similar system in the past. And we obviously want to pursue best practices and methods and mediums for maximum learning and comprehension. So that's the direction that we'd like to move. But in our limited time today, we thought we would just start with this general overview. And I think that's it for us. I think we have one more polling question here before we go to questions. Okay, so we've got a slide there for you all to type into the chat box. For the cultural orientation coordinators, what's the one health-related key message you'd like refugees to understand prior to coming to the U.S.? And for the domestic panelists, you have a promising practice or innovative strategy, and leave us your email. So we have we've purposely left some time here at the end of the presentation for questions. So if you have a question box on your screen, you could type in the questions and we'll try to answer those.
Okay. Thank you, Liz. We will open the question and answer period now. We have already collected some questions and we will start with a couple of questions that were directed at CO coordinators. We'll answer those questions and then we can move to domestic panelists. They could answer a couple of questions and we'll go back and forth. One thing I wanted to point out is that, as we mentioned earlier on in the webinar, we have a webinar on Wednesday of this week, also from 2 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, that will be including updates from all of the overseas CO resettlement support centers and CO programs. So today we will focus on questions having to do with health and mental health and some of the general questions about overseas orientation. If we have some time at the end, we may address some of those, but we will really be addressing those topics much more in depth on Wednesday during that webinar. And also we think we have figured out the sound, so we promise to have better sound on Wednesday, and as I mentioned, if we find out that the recording of the webinar for today is not of good quality, we will be re-recording presentations prior to posting the webinar and the PowerPoint on Cal and RICTAC websites. Okay, so let's go ahead with the first question.
Okay, this is Peter Selnikowski from IOM Nepal, and I have a question. Can you explain the culture shock game with the colored buttons? Well, what we do is we put a pile of green, yellow, and red buttons on the floor. Green corresponds to safe, like street lights. Yellow corresponds to caution, and red corresponds to danger. And then we ask the participants a series of questions. So, for example, one question is, can you speak English? If you can speak English, you take a green button. If you cannot speak English, you take a red button. The assumption is, if you cannot speak English, your chances of suffering culture shock are greater than for someone who can speak English. Other questions are, how old are you? The older you are, the redder the button that you take. Why did you leave your country? If you were forced to leave your country, chances are good that you'll suffer more from culture shock than someone who was happy to leave their country. And questions like that. Once we get finished with all the questions, each person looks at the buttons in their hand and they can see how vulnerable they are to culture shock. Of course, the next part of the lesson is, what do you do about it? Thank you.
Hi, everyone. This is Sarah Krauss from CWS RSC Nairobi, and I have a question here. What do refugees hear about health services in the U.S.? The refugees actually learn a number of things about health services in the U.S. They learn that initial health screenings and immunizations may take place within the first 30 days of arrival. They learn that extensive health care may not be available in the initial weeks of resettlement. And they're also able to learn the difference between urgent and routine health care and be able to identify where to go for each. And then also that the U.S. has no universal health care, but refugee medical assistance differs state by state and in many cases is available for 8 months.
Hi, this is Damir from RSC Istanbul. I have a question. For a family with special health needs, how much counseling do they get about how to obtain care for them? Again, like we have several topics, and the health topic is providing mainly the general answer about the health care. As to regards families with special health needs, we mainly refer them and encourage to seek assistance upon arrival. The reason for this is that during the time that CO is conducted, we do not know as to where they will be resettled and what services will be available. Thank you.
Okay, so now we will turn it over to Jennifer, Liz, and Leslie to answer a few domestic questions, and then we have several more overseas questions, and we can resume those questions and answers after domestic presenters take a few questions.
Great. Thank you, Sonia. And there are a lot of questions and comments coming in. And thank everyone. You know, keep them coming because we will be collating them afterwards. And, you know, really we'll be able to, you know, put together some summary documents here. So there are a couple of questions that have come in, though, for the domestic presenters. And I think that both Leslie and Liz are unmuted here. And one of these I know is a tough answer to a question to answer, but I'm still going to ask it. And that is, you know, how do you measure effectiveness of the domestic health orientation? And if you don't want to answer quite exactly that question, you know, how do you know if you're reaching refugees? What are some of the indicators you may use to say, my work is progressing well here, or maybe it's not?
I think that is a hard question. I think that's probably a place that we also need to put more effort into developing different effective measurement tools. So some of the things that I know that we do, maybe some kind of more on-the-spot types of things that would measure effectiveness is having patients repeat back information and can they repeat back that information. In one of the cultural orientation classes that we teach, I also do a kind of a pre-post test that involves just a raise of hands from, you know, a beginning statement to an end statement, or possibly using like a sticker method for a continuum, maybe did they feel comfortable initially versus how are they feeling now. But definitely a place I think we could put more time and effort into developing those methods.
Yeah, I guess similarly, I would just say, you know, I've done things as simple as having a smiley face scale of, you know, frowning if you didn't learn anything today to smiling broadly if you learned a lot and you would tell your friends about it, something that people can point to or circle on a paper. It's not perfect, but it gives you some idea. And I think also just what I've been able to do at the clinic level is let my providers know exactly what the content is that I'm doing in my health orientations. And so sometimes they'll let me know that they heard the refugees asking questions in a certain way that they know I taught them to ask it, or they're catching the key phrases. And so that's just a kind of informal way that I know that at least something came across or they heard something.
Great, thank you. I have another question for both of you, and I'm going to, once again, I'm going to reframe a little bit the question that came in. And, you know, on the domestic side compared with overseas, even as there's a small amount of time, refugees are resettled here for, they will be here longer. And so many health orientation programs reach refugees at various points during their resettlement pathways. And the question that came in is, how long after arrival do you think it would be appropriate to be providing a more extensive orientation? It's the question that came, but I wonder if you might also talk about, you know, your continuing orientation over a period of time post-resettlement. And again, that's for either Liz or Leslie.
I think that's one of the things that we said we wanted to continue to look into as well. So we're definitely not experts at kind of deciding when that happens. And I also think it's very dependent upon the person. I think there are some people who arrive and can intake a lot of information and put that into practice. And there are others where the cultural jump is much larger, and therefore possibly little bits of information across a much longer continuum would be most effective. And so I know that as we're really only working with very, very newly arrived refugees in the clinic that I work at, but we do try to reach them really within that first week for immediate concerns, then within the next couple of months, at least two or three more times to try to pinpoint more specific things as they've been here a little bit longer.
And I just wanted to add, like Leslie said, we're into researching that as well. We don't have a perfect answer. But for the Association of Refugee Health Coordinators, that we have this newly formed Health Education Committee, and we have a whole subgroup that's working on this overseas to domestic continuum. And so we're really excited about this webinar today, so that maybe it helps us get a better idea of what's done overseas and how we can build on that. And what we're really looking at is coming up with some key messaging or some key images and going off of that principle that repetition helps people retain information. Mm. So that if it could be a continuum from overseas orientation to the refugee health screening, to the resettlement agency, to the ESL classes, to the community ESL classes, and even into the school system. That in an ideal world would be really great. So that messages could be reinforced along the continuum.
Great, thank you. Sonia, I think I'm going to pass it back to you for a couple of questions.
Thank you, Jennifer. Let's address a few more overseas questions, starting with what, if anything, is taught overseas about birth control, and I'm turning it over to Jason Chrysler.
Hello again, everyone. Obviously, this can be a thorny subject, and I can't speak for all programs, but we do in Thailand and Malaysia mention a little bit about sexual and reproductive health. There's no lessons designed around it necessarily, but we do provide some information in student handbooks that we distribute. And if there are questions about it in class, we do discuss it. Obviously, sex in general can be viewed as a taboo subject in a lot of cultures, so we do tread lightly. Basically, our key message is that while it may be a taboo subject, most Americans feel that it's important to be educated about sex and reproductive health and remind them that older children will learn about this in school. Remind them that clinics and doctors can provide information to adults and that visit to a doctor in the U.S., even to get information, is always confidential. We talked very briefly about benefits of birth control, remind people that the lack of family planning and foresight can lead to financial hardship, as well as, you know, reducing risks of unwanted pregnancies and STDs. So it's mentioned, but we don't put a lot of focus on it. We don't want to make any problems for the population, so we keep it general. Okay, I'm passing over to Peter.
Hi, this is Peter from Nepal again. My question is, how do you discuss mental health issues when the topic of mental health itself may be stigmatized? Well, in Nepal, it certainly is stigmatized. People with handicaps of various kinds are often physically and literally locked away. How we handle it is, number one, it's normal to suffer from culture shock. It's normal to be depressed when you are first trying to find your feet in the U.S. You're not going crazy. Second, we don't talk about the people in the class directly. For example, in our culture shock video, we have a family. It's not their family. So we share the experiences of that family. In the end, the participants usually end up saying, oh, that will be like us too. But it's not us that told them that. We try to remove the emotional. We have a lesson on hygiene. So we don't tell them, oh, you people have body odor. You're not going to be accepted in the U.S. Rather, we say that there are different standards of hygiene in different places. And then we just ignore these without saying anything, you know, about the topic. People will come to their own conclusions. It's less threatening.
Okay, we'll take a final question on the overseas side. And that question is, what if a refugee wants to learn more about health issues in the U.S.? Is there a resource overseas? And Jamal Fakur will answer that question.
Hi, everybody. Again, this is Jamal with IOM, and I'm Man Jordan. Before I answer this specific question, I would just like to remind everybody that during CO, we stay as general as possible because we might have 20 refugees sitting in a classroom and all 20 of them are going to different states. So we cannot cover specific information. We have to stay general. And that's why the type of information we provide is not as specific as some of you might like it to be. But again, we only have refugees in for 4 days, 20 hours total, so we stay general. Now, this question about what resources, health issues resources in the U.S. is there available for refugees, and I'm going to speak about specifically IOM Jordan, covering Amman, Baghdad, Damascus, and Cairo. We have developed about 2 years ago what we call online resource guide. It is approved by PRM. It's a DVD, so it has hyperactive linkages to service providers both for health in its, you know, traditional meaning and also in the mental health arena. So there are linkages to refugees that, and as you know, refugees in the Middle East are different than refugees, say, in Africa or Southeast Asia. As many of them are computer savvy and are educated and can navigate internet and find resources, especially if they know to which state they're going to be resettled. But again, that's a different thing. Not too many refugees know which state they're going to be resettled up until very shortly before departure. And in Amman also, we have a resource center that refugees during CO, at the break or after, can go. It has computers and some publications that refugees access. Now, that's not available in every CO program out there. It's just available in Amman and maybe in some one or two CO programs. But that's it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jamal. Before we close the webinar in just a few minutes, we will show the results from some of the previous polls and put a last poll question up there. Also, we will be collecting questions and comments that you shared in the chat box and the comments box, compiling those and sharing them after the webinar. Many, many thanks to all of you for participating in today's webinar. And I will turn it over to Jennifer for any closing comments. Jennifer, if you have any comments.
Thank you, Sonia. I was muted, so it took me a moment to catch up. I would like to thank Sonia, her team at Cal, and all of the speakers for really just a very interesting webinar today. I was a little surprised, well, I won't say I was surprised. The webinar question that we came up with, the polling question, I think that we should clarify, which since we're about split between true and false on the question, I think that we should note that not all refugees complete a health orientation overseas, that in many places it's offered, it's not required, and in some places the orientation may be quite brief, and so the attention to some of the health orientation may not be as much as many of us would like to see. There is one more question that's here, and this is, we are very interested from the Refugee Health TA Center to put together a webinar in the future on some of the promising practices in domestic health orientation. So this is the post-resettlement phase. And I was watching comments coming in, and I think there are many more examples than we could possibly touch on today that people are offering up. So I encourage you to continue to send in your ideas, your promising practices, innovative strategies, and we will hope to put together, if there's interest, a future webinar on domestic health orientation. So thank you, and let me pass it back to Sonia for a final.
So one final reminder that we will have a general webinar on with updates from all of the overseas CO programs on Wednesday, 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So hopefully some of you will join us for that as well. We look forward to sharing the PowerPoints and recordings from this webinar with you shortly, and we will be letting participants know when that will be happening, in addition to compilations of some of the questions and some of the information that we will put together in response to questions that were not addressed today. Thank you so much again to all of the presenters and participants, and goodbye to all.